a significant participant in world trade patterns in the 17th and 18th centuries. There was a chink open still. The Japanese allowed the Dutch to trade near the port of Nagasaki because they recognized that having some outlet to the wider world might still be useful, and the Dutch at this point did not seem particularly menacing, for example, compared to the Catholic Spaniards. So externality was not complete, but an external category would actually work pretty well for Japan in this period. It was consistent with considerable internal commercial growth. The early modern period sees significant development of commercial operations in Japan, new companies processing foods, making beer, this sort of thing. This was a fairly dynamic period in the Japanese economy, but not because of external economic relations of any major sort. But for China, the Middle East, and India, particularly for China, externality simply doesn't work. Here's probably the favorite world history fact currently, and I mention it to you so you can impress your friends. What society received the largest amount of New World silver in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries? The intuitive answer would probably be Spain, or maybe if you recognize that Spain's position eroded after a while, maybe Britain or France. But the actual answer, very definitely, is China. China got more silver from the New World than any other society. And the reason is very simple. Remember the old dilemma that we tend to forget by the early modern period, but still operates. Europeans had long sought Chinese goods. They still sought Chinese goods. It's in the 17th century, for example, that the word China enters the English language to mean porcelain. So they really wanted this stuff. They still have nothing that they can use to pay for it. In a famous passage at the end of the 18th century, a British envoy to the Qing Emperor of China prostrates himself, as one is supposed to do in the presence of this august figure, but urges that the Chinese open their markets to the British. He carries the letter from the British monarch urging this opening, and the Chinese emperor is very vigorous in reply. Thank you very much, but there's nothing from the outside world that we need. Why don't you go home? The Chinese simply did not need European goods. They produced better goods themselves, or they didn't want them, as in the case of massive supplies of guns. So, what were the Europeans to do? In the early modern period, the dilemma is an old one. We've seen it in the post-classical period. But in the early modern period, there is a new European answer. Hooray, we now have silver from the New World, and we'll send this to the Chinese. This is where the Europeans appear not just as dynamic economic entrepreneurs and manufacturers, though they have this role in certain areas, but as transmitters. They're simply taking a valued American good as carriers to the Chinese and getting what they want in return. Silver flooded China with significant impact. In the 17th century, the Chinese government decides, for example, that all taxes must now be paid in silver currency, a huge challenge to many ordinary peasants who had to increase their market activities in order to try to earn the silver that they would have to use for taxation purposes. Social inequality almost certainly increased in China. There's a lot of adverse criticism by Chinese observers about this monetarization and commercialization of Chinese society. So the point is not just that China's making a lot of profit from this system, but that it's a profit level that will affect Chinese society in other ways as well. But the point for the world economy theory is clearly China is an active participant, but it doesn't quite fit any of the models that Wallerstein has put forward. It's not external. You couldn't possibly earn this much New World silver and be regarded as external. You are involved in world trade. You are impacted by world trade. But it's not exactly core either, although that might be the closest fit. It's not core because Chinese merchants and ships are not going out to the world as a whole. China is a production powerhouse, and many Chinese today, as China's manufacturing position again becomes central to global trade, argue that China is quite simply restoring what it had once achieved after a brief and troubled interruption, an interesting vantage point that we will return to. China was a manufacturing powerhouse. It was not, for foreign trade purposes, a commercial powerhouse. It did trade actively still with Southeast Asia. Again, want to dispel any notion that the Chinese are just sitting there letting Westerners bring stuff to them, or that the Chinese are somehow disinclined to trade. But on a global basis, the Chinese clearly are not operating the way a core society is supposed to. They have a strong government. They might fit a core definition in other respects, but the category just has to be adjusted. This is a different situation. Some of the same comments apply to India, at least until the 18th century. India is the second largest recipient of New World silver because the Indians also have a variety of goods that Europeans want. They have fine cotton and other kinds of cloth. They have spices. They have a mixture, in other words, of specialized agricultural products and manufactured products. And again, they have very little need for European goods during the early modern period. New World silver is, once more, the grease that operates this particular commercial machine. As we've noted, by the 18th century, when foreign intervention increases in India, this enviable position may begin to shift into a clearer dependent category. But for most of the early modern period, India and the Middle East as well trade with some advantage with Europeans. They're not dominated by Europeans, but they're not removed from international trade either. You simply need, for the early modern period at least, a separate Asian category that would then allow for specific cases such as Japan. All right. I think it's pretty clear, though again, argument is welcome. I think it's pretty clear that a modified early modern world economy system makes considerable sense. European dominance with regard to Latin America, to some extent Africa, and increasingly some parts of Eastern Europe, European economic dominance is very real. It's a source of new profits for the West. It's a source of new patterns of economic and political activity for the peripheral societies involved. This is not yet a world system. It does not yet embrace most of Asia. It needs to be modified to take changes into account, not only the economic decline of Spain and Portugal, but the new position of India, and we'll talk about some relevant changes for Russia in a later comment as well. So we need to add to Wallerstein a sense of change. We need to recognize that his picture must be complicated by factors such as population shortage, cultural attitudes, etc. And we need to make a great big adjustment for many key parts of Asia, as against not only his tendency, but also the larger stereotypes that are simply wrong for this period. But with these adjustments, I think we come back to the three key points that I suggested at the outset. Properly adjusted, Wallerstein does explain why different societies fell into some systematic patterns of inequality in the international marketplace in the early modern period. He does explain why weak government has some relationship to dependent economic status. And above all, though here we can only make a statement at this point, we'll come back to it as we move on in time, he does explain why this system tended to be so persistent. It is possible to fall out of the core. Spain and Portugal did, if you don't make full use of your economic superiority. But it's hard, because you make enough money from this system that you can make some mistakes and still be on top. It's even harder, probably, to climb out of the periphery. If you're not making money from the world economic system, if your labor force is abused and impoverished, if your merchant class is small, it's going to be very difficult to change this position. Not impossible, because we have to see later on that societies do emerge. But persistence, the connections between early modern economic relationships and even contemporary economic issues in the world economy, this connection is vivid, and this demonstrates the persistence of the kinds of categories Wallerstein establishes.
Lecture 21, Transformations in Western Europe.
It's no secret that the early modern centuries constituted an exceptionally busy time for Western Europe. Lots of changes, lots of significant movements. We'll be dealing with basic shifts in our discussion today, but we need to begin with a slight sense of caution and certainly a concern with making sure the developments we'll be discussing fit into a world history context. The list of major European activities is formidable. You start with the Renaissance. The Italian Renaissance began before 1450, of course, but 1450 itself is the conventional date at which one notes the migration of the Renaissance to the north. The 16th century saw the Protestant Reformation, the Catholic Reformation in response, the price or commercial revolution that was stimulated by the advent of precious metals from the New World and which encouraged additional commercial activity in Europe. The 17th century sees the rise of absolutism, the variant that developed in Britain and the Netherlands with the emergence of a more modern form of parliamentary monarchy. And, of course, it saw the Scientific Revolution, one of the incontestably great developments of the early modern period. The 18th century sees, above all, the Enlightenment, a popularization and expansion of scientific thinking, but it also sees the application of some Enlightenment ideas to absolute monarchy in the form of enlightened despotism. The list is obviously considerable, and it's important. The issue, for starters, however, is how we make sure that this range of developments in Western Europe becomes manageable enough to fit into a world history pattern. Let me illustrate by raising a specific question, which I won't exactly answer, though I'm going to imply my own reaction. How much, from the standpoint of world history, do we need to know about the European Renaissance? Here's one of the great staples, the glorious staples of the tradition of Western civilization, lovingly detailed, particularly by people interested in artistic and cultural history. But from a world history standpoint, how much time can one afford to spend on the Renaissance? How much attention does it absolutely require? My own, and here I will sort of answer from my own standpoint, my own reaction is, frankly, probably not much, but it can be debated. Certainly, world history does not afford the opportunity to spend as much time on Renaissance, then Reformation, then science, then Enlightenment, as one would offer in a Western civilization approach. You just have to be more selective. So, we're going to talk first about a big changes approach. That is, instead of going through Renaissance, Reformation, blah, 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 we're going to be talking about what are the big ways that Western Europe shifted between 1450 and 1750. This does not do full justice to all of the individual movements and currents, which, after all, were, among other things, not entirely consistent. Renaissance, for example, more secular spirit. Reformation returns to a greater religious emphasis. These eddies are obviously extremely important if one has the luxury of a Western civilization framework, but they're not necessarily any more important than some of the countercurrents that one could also encounter in China, the Middle East, sub-Saharan Africa, etc. We have to look at the bigger picture. So we'll be talking in the first instance about major categories of change, many of which, frankly, focus a bit more on the second half of the early modern period than on the first half, though, of course, they're prepared by developments earlier on. Two other controls are vital. In the first place, in addition to simplifying the usual picture so that it becomes appropriate for a world history framework, we will at the end talk more explicitly about, okay, these things happened in the West. What are their global implications? This will be brief, but obviously is also intended to make sure we don't get lost in the Western forest and lose sight of the bigger picture. I've mangled a metaphor there, but you know what I mean. The final control within this discussion itself is, I think, a really interesting one, and I venture it here a little bit cautiously, but I actually think it'll work. What was going on in the West from a world history standpoint? What was going on in the West in the early modern period was partly playing catch-up. Remember, the West had been, by the top global standards, a somewhat backward society during the post-classical period, though it changed a lot and was beginning to move into a more global orbit by the end of the post-classical. But in the early modern period, the West does a number of things that bring it close to the levels already achieved in places like China and the Middle East. Now, of course, it did so in specific ways that are Western. But in broader outline, we will see, and I'll be able to point this out explicitly, we'll be able to see how the West adjusted, consciously or unconsciously, to existing global standards. But the second angle is involves attention to where the West actually innovated, did not follow basic patterns laid out already. So we'll need to evaluate the big changes we'll be focusing on in terms of their placement, either as basically catch-up with, again, perhaps a special Western twist, or as fundamentally innovative. And I think this framework is actually quite interesting and appropriate. Of course, finally, we need to remember that what was going on in the West is matched by important developments in other parts of the world, and we'll have a chance to come back to that in subsequent discussions. The big changes in the West in the early modern period fall into four basic categories. One I will merely mention because we've already covered it, but in a way it was the granddaddy of all categories, and that was the increasing place that the West was winning in world trade and, to a lesser extent, in world power politics. From world trade, the West gained access to new kinds of ideas, new perspectives. It certainly gained access to new levels of wealth and commercial opportunity. So remember that, although we're now going to focus on the other three big developments, this repositioning in the world was a fundamental change in and of itself. The other big developments involved an increasing commercialization of the West European economy, obviously pretty closely tied to global developments. Significant changes in politics along lines of increasing governmental efficiency and rationalization. And finally, significant, even fundamental shifts in cultural outlook and the way many Europeans began to think about the world. These developments occurred at the same time. They overlapped. They could reinforce each other. But I think it's useful initially to look at them one by one. Commercialization. During the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, fairly steadily, more and more Europeans became involved in a commercial economy producing at least some goods for sale on the market, for sale for money. This included farmers, for example. It was only in the 17th century that southern French peasants and landlords began producing wine for sale to other regions, thus involving themselves in importing other kinds of food they would need. Individual villages began to specialize in shoe production or nail production or scissors or cutlery production. Both in agriculture and in manufacturing, ordinary people, as well as merchants and landlords, began producing more for the market, began adopting an increasingly explicit set of market motivations and practices. The development was uneven. You can find a commercial village right next to a very traditional, self-sufficient one, but the general tendency was quite marked. This meant, of course, also a growing importance for the merchant class of Western Europe, which expanded, gained wealth both from international and from domestic trade. The expansion of a merchant and capitalist sector was an important part of this phenomenon. Absolutely crucial, as mentioned already in discussions of the world economy, was the expansion of domestic manufacturing in Western Europe, that system by which rural people, while still possibly doing some farming, devoted an increasing amount of their effort to producing goods for sale to merchants in nearby cities, goods like textiles, particularly of various sorts, but also, again, metal products, shoes, potentially other items. So, from the 16th through the 18th century, a steady expansion of European commercialization. This had a couple of other corollaries. Most important, commercialization was accompanied by a growing gap between the large numbers of people who owned some property, an artisan shop, a bit of land, whatever, and an equally rapidly growing group of essentially propertyless or near propertyless workers dependent on sale of their labor for a wage. In other words, European class structure shifted away from the more community-based relationships that had predominated during the post-classical centuries. Along with this in turn, and it's a striking development, even as early as the late 16th century, came a new and frankly harsher attitude toward poverty. Along with traditional religious views that the poor should receive charity, that they would always be with us, came an increasing sense that frankly, if you were poor, there must be something wrong with you, and maybe not every poor person deserved assistance. This is an attitude that obviously still lingers in the Western psyche, although some other attitudes have joined in as well. The commercialization of the European economy, the expansion of domestic manufacturing, the increasing production of food products for sale on urban markets, etc., in broad outline, were catch-up developments. They brought Europe to economic levels that had previously been achieved in places like China and other parts of Asia. They were not, again, aside from individual peculiarities, they were not in and of themselves distinctive on the world scene. Attitudes toward poverty maybe had a little bit of additional edge. The witchcraft scare that was such an interesting sign of ongoing tension in European life in the 16th and 17th centuries had something to do with the new social framework that the Europeans were creating. A disproportionate number of accused witches were poor people, particularly poor women, feared among other things because of the new sense of hostility toward poverty. So a few special twists, but in broad outline, this is a catch-up development. By the 18th century, however, still on the theme of commercialization, developments began to press beyond a mere catch-up level in two senses. First, by this point, the expansion of domestic manufacturing and now the beginnings of new technologies, for example, the flying shuttle in weaving of cloth, new technologies designed to increase the productivity of manual workers. These developments began to push the European economy beyond levels that had been achieved in other societies. It's still within range, but you're beginning to get a level of commercialization, attention to manufacturing and productivity levels that are on the verge, at least, of becoming distinctive. The other 18th century development, and this is a striking recent historical discovery, the other 18th century development was the beginning of modern consumerism in Western Europe. We have noted at several earlier points that consumerism is hardly a purely modern phenomenon. Upper classes frequently indulged in a delight in material goods that they did not strictly need, and a capacity to gain some sense of purpose and identity from consumer activities. But it's in the 17th, 18th centuries in Western Europe that consumerism begins to spread beneath the upper class and merchant level to more ordinary people, not everybody, of course, but to more ordinary people. And it's at this point also that consumer interests begin to take on the contours of some real passion. For example, in the 18th century, thefts of clothing accelerated massively, a sign that people were beginning to want things as part of their personal set of values and identities and would be willing to go beyond the law in order to obtain them. And again, things they did not, strictly speaking, need. This discovery that a modern form of consumerism predates the Industrial Revolution and centered in Western Europe is indeed an important addition to our sense of what commercialization could accomplish. Increasing commercial activity, largely in the catch-up mode, but capable of pressing beyond that level to more genuine innovation on a world scale. Second category of development, politics. Until the 17th century, despite the rise of individual monarchs or the Renaissance city-state, until the 17th century, European politics can still broadly be described in the terms of earlier emphasis on feudalism. But by the 17th century, though feudal remnants lingered, by the 17th century, European states, particularly in absolute monarchies like that of France, European states were beginning to develop a new range of activities and a new sense of rationalization. Let me illustrate. First of all, fairly familiar development, central governments now began to send out an increasing number of bureaucrats to the provinces to make sure that central edicts were enforced more uniformly throughout the realm, and local conditions in turn could be monitored by central authorities. It was at this point, for example, that national boundaries between countries like France and Spain began really to matter, because it now mattered which state you belonged to. New functions also included activities such as cultural intervention. It was in the 17th century that the French monarchy decided that it should set up an institution to help monitor and regularize the French language, an activity that the French state still conducts, perhaps in a more beleaguered fashion, in the present day. It was in this period also that European states began to set up prisons, a tremendous change in potential operations in criminal justice, and a considerable expansion of the role of the state in dealing with criminals. The list is long. Along with expansion of function came this process we call rationalization, an increasingly self-conscious effort to think through how government activities were organized. The military serves as a prime example here. Again, it was in the 17th century that many European armies began to acquire set uniforms, that officer grades began to be systematically defined so there was a clear hierarchy of progression, that training for certain kinds of officers, particularly military engineers, began to be formalized, that new activities like hospitals and logistical systems for armies began to be organized so that when an army moved through the countryside, it would not simply be living off the land, and even military pensions established. European states became more active, conducting a wider array of functions, and their activities were increasingly rationalized. Now, here too, in broad outline, most of this was catch-up. That is, European governments are now beginning to do things that political systems in several other societies, China obviously at the head, had done well before this. Again, particular European emphases. The prison system seems to have been unusually stressed in Europe, for example. But the broad patterns are familiar. There's no fundamental innovation. Europe gained increasingly the political capacity to operate on a global stage in tandem with the most advanced political systems in other societies. That's an important development, but it's not fundamentally novel. But here too, particularly by the 17th and 18th centuries, a distinctive twist that was more innovative, and that is the clear beginnings of the idea of a nation state. That is, a state in which a definition of shared culture and tradition would coexist with the state itself. This is a novel development. You might find hints of it in patterns that the Chinese had conducted earlier, but fundamentally, most states previously had not called on active loyalty of subjects to the extent that the nation-state did. And they had not assumed that the state and the cultural orbit were coterminous. The nation-state concept, which would obviously develop still further in the later 18th and 19th centuries, was a fundamental